Adam's from New York, and she's going to she's going to come up and tell a story. Yeah, I came a long way to be here because it was told to me early on in recovery, you know, that to be a willing participant in my recovery and to be willing to be inconvenienced for AA because people came from, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours away sometimes to carry a message home to me in York, Pennsylvania, when I was still sick and suffering. So I tried to make myself available and to be inconvenienced for AA, and I'm gratefully indebted to this program, I really am. So I'm here tonight to tell you a little bit about what my journey was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. My home group is the Bug Light Group, and we meet in York, actually Dallas Town, Pennsylvania, just close to York. The Bug Light Group, not the Bud Light Group. We meet Saturday night at 7 o'clock in Dallas. I'm sure there is a Bud Light Group somewhere in the vicinity, so if you're not in the spiritual that day, I'm sure you can find a solution there. But we have a solution for alcoholism, and we just try to share a message of hope, you know, that's still sick and suffering alcohol. It's a 1-hour speaker meeting. So I have a home group, I have a sponsor. I have the privilege of taking other women through the steps in this program. My sobriety date is January 14th of 2006. So God willing, I'll be coming up in 7 years soon, so it's pretty cool.
Alright.
Take one at a time, we'll see what happens on the 14th. But no, there's certain things, you know, that I do on a daily basis that ensure my continuous and happy sobriety. So part of those things, you know, is what I just described, you know, sponsorship and having a home group and staying committed and willing to be inconvenienced for AA. But these things didn't happen overnight. So I grew up a very selfish and self-centered, you know, young woman in northern New Jersey. That in and of itself does not make me an alcoholic. Growing up in New Jersey does not look like a change in becoming an alcoholic, no matter how much that show wants to portray us to be. I did spend many a summer down the Jersey Shore, and I grew up fast during those summers. There was definitely alcohol involved in my summers. But I had a pretty normal childhood. For all intents and purposes, you know, people looking, you know, from the outside in would say, you know, that I had a very normal childhood. I'm the oldest of 4 kids. So I have a younger sister who's 4 years younger than me, and 2 younger brothers. And that, you know, that's a curse and a blessing. You know, there's you know, double standards that go on there. The curse is, of course, that, you know, I was the first to test the waters and everything, you know, the lying, the drinking, the partying, the boyfriend, that kind of stuff. So I tended to get more consequences than I see my younger brothers incurring. I've kind of worn down my parents, like, really well, though, with my drinking, so they have it a little easier than I did. And the blessing was that my parents liked to travel, they liked to go on vacations. I was, you know, 16, 17, driving, and looked like a responsible enough young adult to look after these little kids. So my parents would, you know, set aside $200 emergency fund in case, you know, something should happen and I should have to, you know, use this money. That money would quickly be allocated towards booze, you know, and I'd give each kid like $5 and be like, here's the fee for delivering this phone number, go lock her on your own. And I was just like a horrible, horrible sister. I really was. And then I would invite over 200 of my closest friends to the house and charge $5 a head, you know, for a solo cup, so I'd be making money off this too. My younger sister, she was, like I said, 4 years younger than me, so she's close enough in age that I could bribe her with 2 beers and she could have been off, so she would have been telling my parents what was going on. my younger brothers posed quite a different problem. Because they were, old enough to know what's going on, that, I was having this crazy house party and I shouldn't be. But, not young enough that I could give them alcohol. But I found out that if I convinced them that they had colds and give them adult doses of NyQuil, that took care of that situation pretty easily for me. And if they wouldn't take it willingly, I'd sip it in soda. And make them drink a funny tasting soda. So these are my tools. These are my tools, growing up. These are my survival skills, and I'd lock them in, their bedroom, and I'd have, a great time with some of my closest friends. And of course, alcohol was involved, and what that allowed me to do was to be comfortable in my own skin amongst 200 of my peers, and that's just not something that, by default, that I am. By default, I was always restless, irritable, and discontent with the tribes. I just didn't have that terminology to describe it. So growing up, before the drink, before these parties and all this, right? It was always apparent to me that I was not like other people. I was not like the kids in my class. I was not like my team members from all these sports I was playing. I always just felt separate and different. And I just always felt that my skin was just way too tight. And it was always just a struggle to face you and to perform the way that, I thought people wanted me to perform. My head was consistently running, about what fear, just constant selfish and self-centered fear about what I thought you thought about me, and I didn't identify it as selfish and self-centered fear. I identified it as anxiety. I thought maybe I had an anxiety disorder. I identified it as people's expectations were too much for me. People had very high expectations that I could never live up to. So it was their fault for having those expectations. So there was a lot of things, that I thought could be the problem before I took the drink. I took my first drink, and I guess this is pretty monumental for an alcoholic. I took my first drink when I was 13 years old, and I was on a ski vacation with my parents, and my cousin, my older cousin, came along with us. Now, at this point, even if you were a family member of mine, I was so consumed with selfish and self-centered fear that I was even concerned with what you thought about me if I was cool enough to be hanging out with you. And he's my cousin, so he basically has to hang out with me. We're in the middle of Vermont, there's nobody around, but I'm still thinking, am I cool enough to be hanging out with him? And so everybody went to bed, and he had suggested that we break into the owner's closet of this rental unit that we had and just get some alcohol. And I was absolutely, I do that all the time. And it was like, okay, well, then you go do that. So I was tasked with, prying open the owner's closet and procuring some alcohol of some sort. I had no idea what I was doing. And I can tell you this. I don't know what I wore to my senior graduation. I don't know what I wore to any of the proms I attended, although that probably didn't stay on very long. Alcohol is like clothes and drinking don't really mix very well. They don't last very well together. So I don't remember what I wore to my proms. I don't remember what I wore, when I had my first kids or any of these things. I remember exactly what I wore the very first time I took a drink. And it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that it dawned on me, that I might be alcoholic if I know that when I was 13 years old on a ski vacation with my cousin, I happened to be wearing a pair of Jenkos, which, for those of you who don't know, that is an absurdly huge pants. Just absurdly huge. That fit actually, a bottle of Tanqueray very, very nicely in the pocket because they are this big. I mean, they're huge. Pair of Jenkos, ruby red Airwalks that I loved to death, Scooby-Doo t-shirt, and so, I don't know, these things are just indelible in my mind for some reason, so maybe it was some sort of a, monumental spiritual experience for me, and I remember when I took that first swig of Tanqueray or Hennessy or whatever it was, that, my mouth burned and my eyes watered, and my ears popped, and I remember thinking immediately, why the heck do adults drink this? And then, 10 minutes later, it was followed by the ease and comfort that followed that. And that was a pretty big deal for me, because all of a sudden I was no longer concerned with, am I cool enough to be hanging out with my cousin? It was, you know, everything just was quiet, and I was at peace and ease. And that's the first time I really found that kind of peace and ease up until that point in my life. It's not like I had equated that drink or being drunk with the solution to life's problems, and it's not like I was drinking every day, you know, all day that went on. I did equate it, though, with me some of ease and comfort, and that stuck with me. And so from 13 on, whenever alcohol was offered, I was certainly rearranging my schedule to be able to take part. And that would mean consequences, like if a friend of a friend's brother was hanging out in the woods with a bottle or something, I was going to go, hang out with him and not attend a birthday party. It was consequences like, when I'd have those house parties, my parents would obviously know that something happened because the landscape would be uprooted and there would be fire trucks in the front lawn and I couldn't rethaw the lawn in 24 hours. And the contents of the refrigerator would be thrown at the front of the house, this kind of stuff. So I'd be grounded. There were consequences to that kind of behavior in my house, and I'd be grounded for months on end, and things would be taken away from me, and I would learn that I was willing to pay much higher prices to drink the way that I like to drink. But at this point, it seemingly was innocuous, kind of teenage rite of passage type of stuff. From the outside, that's what it looked like. I knew that on the inside that there was something very powerful going on with alcohol. And I drank as if always, every single time, from the very first time I drank until the very end, I always drank as if it was the world's last ration of alcohol in front of me. And it was like, I better get this done. I better get this done right, because I don't know if I'm going to ever get to do this again. That was always the mindset. For some reason, I had that peculiar mind twist, that comes with alcoholism that makes you think that way. So I went through high school. I played a lot of sports. I was a cheerleader, and for a period of time, I played ice hockey, and I was playing travel girls ice hockey, and I was a competitive dancer, and I played field hockey and softball and all this great stuff. And unfortunately, my default state of being selfish and self-centered to the core and uncomfortable in my own skin did not make me the best of friends with people for very long. By the end of my senior year, I could say that I was, not very good friends with anybody, but I was very, amicable with most people. So, looking back on it, once I got into AA, what I could identify what was really happening was that I would befriend a group of people, I would take from them everything that they had to offer, whether that was your boyfriend, your money, your booze, your attention, whatever it was, until you had nothing left to give me. And when you had nothing left to give me, I was looking for a new set of friends. And that went on relentlessly until my senior year. So if you looked at my wardrobe, if you looked into my closet by the end of my senior year, you would think I was schizophrenic. You would have been like, I don't know, if the girl's coming or going, she's going to rage, she's going to a hippie dance festival, she's really there, what is wrong with this girl? By the end of my senior year, I had run through all these cliques and all these groups of people, and there was this last stand, this group of people that I had yet to try to befriend, and they looked like they were really comfortable in their own skin all the time, in our class especially, and there was this group of hippies, and I stand before you today very much the way I was in high school, and so I tried to become friends with these people, and they were like, who is this Valley Girl Mark? And what does she want with us, And so I was able to show them that we had common interests in getting out of ourselves, and they showed me some new ways to get out of myself, and I showed them some, tricks as well. And we found common ground in that. And that, I just kind of got sucked into this counterculture, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it, everything we did. And I wouldn't give up those days for anything. I wouldn't, I don't regret any of it. Was a speaker, and I was always speaking. I was always, that's just kind of was always my nature. I mean, a lot of alcoholics tend to be that way. So I was a speaker, and I was I just got I felt like what Bill describes in the Big Book, like, I had arrived. Like, this was the solution. Capitalism was a problem, you know? I'm never going to let a man get me down, you know? I'm never going to work a 9-to-5, and I'm just going to, like, sleep on my parents' couch for the rest of my life, and everything's going to be fine, because, you know, I'm obtaining enlightenment, you know, by staring at static on the television for 24 hours straight. I am, at one point, in full-blown delusion, thinking that the movie Being John Malkovich tells the secrets of the universe. And if I don't really remember it, then I'm going to be fine. You know, I really, really felt that I was a reincarnation of Jim Morrison's Girl from Pam. Well, I actually died like a year after I was born. I don't know how that works out. Whatever I wrote about reincarnation doesn't seem to work that way, but in my head, I have, you know, I would introduce myself as such to people. I like traveling around with bands, you know, and it was a lot of fun. It was, I would travel around with this, you know, group of band of gypsies, really, you know, and we'd get to, like, this concert, you know, my favorite band ever, and the sad part is that what I like to do is in the parking lot. So I wouldn't necessarily make it into the show. I'd be like crawling around the parking lot for 4 hours until my friends exited the show and picked me up and took me home. So there were consequences there too. Nothing crazy though, you know, nothing too bad. Eventually what had happened was I decided instead of going to a college for your institution, which I, you know, my parents were willing. Totally willing. My parents are innately loving and kind people, and they lay down their lives for their children. They really do, and they had afforded me the opportunity to, you know, go to a four-year college, and of course, my selfish and self-centered thinking had prevented me from doing that, because all I could think about is who am I going to be friends with there, and how am I going to get what I need here, and, you know, who's going to feed me, and who's going to do my laundry, and all that kind of stuff. So I had a lot of fear about going away to school, so much to my parents, you know, I'm sure that they were very disappointed when I decided to go to a two-year community college that was down the street from my house. I could walk there. So, I spent a couple of years on their couch, and eventually what had happened was my friends were moving on to other forms of alcohol that got them out of themselves a lot quicker than the forms we were previously using. And, you know, I wasn't naive. I'm a graduate of the DARE program, you know. I grew up in the Nancy Reagan administration, the Just Say No, you know, administration. I knew full and well what could lie in my future, you know, if I pick up this form of alcohol. But the reality of it was that alcohol wasn't quite working for me the way that it used to. And when it used to be such a great solution for this, you know, constant running fear and tension and angst that I had that I was filled with, it was being less and less effective at being a solution for that. So I don't know. So I was going to college and I, you know, eventually I stopped going to class because, you know, no matter how much alcohol I put into me. When I went to go, you know, walk across campus to get to my class, my heart would palpitate and my palms would sweat and my head would be racing. And I was a mess, full mess. And by the time I got to class, it was just, I couldn't absorb anything. I was too selfish. My head was just too consumed with self to concentrate. And so I tuned out, and my parents, you know, eventually caught on to the fact that I was not attending class, even though I was saying I was attending class or sitting in the parking lot in my Jeep. They found out, and this was really like the first, you know, warning sign to them, and they said to me, you know, what's going on, and I told them about the anxiety attacks, and they were like, Heather, you should have come to us sooner, you know, there are people, professionals in this world that are here that can help you with this sort of thing. And so they sent me to therapy. Oh my gosh, my favorite thing in the whole wide world is to talk about myself for an hour. Convince you that other people are the problem and I need with a prescription in hand. You know, I thought that was the greatest deal in the world. I really did. So I would do just that, exactly that. You know, I'd show up, I'd lie about my circumstances, I would lie about my drinking. I'm a great manipulator. I really, really am. Like, I can really convince you that other people and other external factors are really the problem here. And I, you know, I didn't. I had this therapist who was around. And so, you know, needless to say that that was not, you know, a very good solution to my anxiety, you know, because, you know, I would lie, he would give me some that I wasn't taking as prescribed, and I was doing other things on the side, you know. And so I was kind of stuck here, you know. I was stuck at that point where alcohol was no longer working and I needed to do something different. And I just knew that I didn't like the way that I felt sober, but I still didn't think that I had a problem, you know, with alcohol. I really didn't see that as a problem. I knew I had a problem being sober. You know, I didn't equate that with alcoholism. I didn't like that term. I don't know. And maybe it was just never described to me yet in the way that I needed to hear it. So my friends move on to bigger and better forms of alcohol. I move on to bigger and better forms of alcohol. The forms that I'm using, you know, tremendous amounts of weight. I'm like down to 100 pounds. I'm quickly realizing that this newfound form of alcohol, I'm not going to be able to get away with doing this in my parents' house. And I should probably find a boyfriend who lives closer to where my bartender lives. And he should probably be this boyfriend, right? He should probably need me in some sort of way, because if he didn't need me at this point in time, he would not want to be around me. And so I found him. He, you know, lived in New York, and he had cancer, and he had no car, and he had no job, and he lived with his parents in, like, a sufficiency suite in their house, and it was just, like, the perfect setup for me and my rampant alcoholism. Now, of course, you know, looking back, I can see how opportunistic I was. At the time, I really did have really good intentions. And that's another thing that I think is really indicative of alcoholics, is that we have the best intentions in the world. I really do. I think that we are good-hearted people. We always have the best intentions. But the unfortunate, you know, part of our disease is that we can never live up to them. You know, and that's the story of my life. I can never, ever live up to my intentions. So I went in there, you know, thinking that I really did love him, and I really felt that, you know, I really could take care of him, and I was going to give him a better life, and I was going to get him to chemotherapy, and we were going to fight this thing, and blah, blah, blah. And what really happened was I showed up there a complete mess. I robbed his, you know, family. I robbed him of his drugs. There were days where it came down between me going to the bartender or him going to chemotherapy, and I lost the power of choice, you know. And my intentions were never, ever, ever to hurt this person, never, ever to put his life, you know, in danger. But unfortunately, my alcoholism doesn't seem to give me that choice. There's no question. I didn't think twice about that, you know, that decision. And then I'm left with the guilt and remorse, you know, of my actions the day before, and I drink more. And so I'm kind of burying myself in this really, you know, this deep hole, I'm in this downward spiral, and it's getting really, really nasty. Eventually, what happened was, he had enough of me after 4 years holding him hostage, and he called my parents that after a couple of weeks, and the police showed up, and thankfully they took pity on me, so I was just a vapid, you know, shell of a human being. I really was. There's just nothing left to me. And they were like, you know, maybe you need to get some help, and we're not going to take you to jail, but you really need to, like, tell your parents what's seriously going on here, and we'll take you to the hospital. So I really thought when I told my parents that what had become of me and what was really going on, that was going to be it. They were going to cut me out of the family. I had not known anybody to have alcoholism to the extent that I was suffering from it in my family before, and so I really thought they were just going to write me off, and this is going to be it. They changed the locks and the doors, and, you know, have fun out there, you can see it. But my parents are innately loving and kind people, and they show up with open arms, and they tell me that they will do whatever it takes in order to get me the best help that they can afford. And if parents love and support, and your family support and money and therapists and great, you know, psychiatric drugs and the best treatment facilities in the world to get you sober, I would have, you know, 15 years sober, you know, and not 7. And really what this did is just kind of started my tour of the nation via rehab, you know. So I went on tour. And I go into a facility, you know, sometimes with really bad intentions. Yeah, sometimes I just do not want to be sober. I just didn't want to be sober. But I get, you know, pushed into a corner, and I'd go in there, and I would try to convince, like, 5-10 people to speak with me, so that I'm going to be okay. I'd try to convince the patients to run away with me. You know, sometimes I was drinking, you know, while in those treatment facilities. Sometimes, you know, I would just completely just run away and fall off the grid. And other times, you know, because in between these bouts in rehab, things were getting really, really nasty. The consequences I was incurring were pretty dramatic and pretty bad. Because, you know, time after time, people, getting people's hopes up and then again letting them down, they no longer wanted to be around me because it was causing them so much pain to watch me go through this. The boyfriend was gone, the bandages, they were long gone. My parents, you know, started, you know, shutting their doors on me and locking the key. I was no longer welcome in their house. And so I would find myself living in my car in a dumpy down parking lot. I would find myself having guns put to my head, you know, being tied up in 4-point restraints and psych wards, you know, going to jail, that kind of stuff. None of that, seriously, never even dawned on me to take a look at my drinking. Because I felt like if you felt the way that I did sober, you would do anything that you needed to do as well to get relief. And always felt very justified in that. The consequences and the pain of the day before does not keep an alcoholic sober. It just doesn't. You know, that baffled my parents. It really did. It baffled everybody around me. You know, look what you've become. Look what you've your family. Look at all these things that you've had to go through, Heather. You know, don't you think you've had enough? You know. And the unfortunate part of that is if I could just not drink, I just wouldn't drink. You know, it would be that simple. But unfortunately for me, you know, or fortunately for me, I have a spiritual malady, you know, and it takes a spiritual solution in order to get me to be able to lift that disease of perception so that I can find my solution. But at this point, I'm still pretty thick-headed and egocentric, you know, and very, very shut off from the idea and concept of a loving God being a solution for me. And so every rehab that I ever went into would tell me about a spiritual solution found in the 12 steps. And I would be just so deeply, just so antagonized by that. You know, there's something about that just rubbed me the wrong way. When anybody ever talked about God, I would just completely shut off because I was that far removed. Eventually what had happened was I was out on bail from my most recent stay in a prison, and they had sent me to another treatment facility, and I had to finish this 2-month stay there, and if I did that, then I could go to recovery office and yada yada yada, and I wouldn't have to back to jail. And I get to this treatment facility, and I'm there, and I'm 2 months sober when I arrive from jail, and I had never, ever, ever before felt so crazy and so out of my mind and just completely separate from the human race. Just completely, completely separate. And if you're an alcoholic like me and you are that uncomfortable sober, suicide starts looking like a really good option. And so I'm in this treatment facility and trying to tell myself, and they find out, you know, they catch me doing this. And they tell me that, this is my third time there, by the way, in Norristown. And they tell me that they don't have the resources to help somebody like me there. And so they say, you know, you need to find another treatment facility tonight because we can't have you in here anymore. And so they ask me to leave, and I called my dad, and he would pick me up, and he would take me to another facility. And so I was breaking my bail. So they took me right from, you know, the treatment facility I was in across the street, to the Norristown Correctional Facility, where they put me in voluntary confinement, you know, 2 months over. Here I am, 2 months over, suicidal. I can't form full sentences. I am doing things like trying to stab myself with the fork that they give you. Yeah. I am eating the soap and the shampoo and thinking that maybe it has some form of alcohol in it, or maybe they'll take me somewhere to give me some form of alcohol. If I injured myself, I would take seizures. I would try to drown myself in the toilet. I was just really, really at my end with this thing. I really was. And it was at the point, you know, like, come here, hear me. You know, I just can't keep on going the way I'm going. And what happened was, so they were tied me down in 4-point restraints in solitary confinement. And they take everything out of my cell because I need to go. So there's nothing in my cell whatsoever, paper bound, and that's it. And I come to the next day, I'm out of my restraints, and there was this pamphlet about God. I don't remember verbatim exactly what it said. I do know that it spoke of general spiritual principles. And I picked it up and read it because I had nothing better to do, obviously. And I read it, and for the first time in my entire life, I had hope that there might be something out there bigger than me that might be able to save me from whatever it is that I'm suffering from, because I don't even think that this is alcoholism at this point. I think I'm so far gone. I'm sober. Here I am, 2 months physically separated from the drink. Why am I still like this? You know, and a wave of ease and comfort came over me, much like the drink, you know, had produced. And I thought maybe there might be something here. And there, it wasn't like I had this great relationship with God from that day forward or anything like that. My ego had just been beaten down to the state that I was able to receive a very, very small but important message. So I spent a little bit more time in that prison. My parents had really thought that I was just way too far gone to be reintegrated into society in any sort of way. So they were trying to get me to sign over power of attorney to them, and they were going to put me in a state psych facility. And that looked like a great idea to me at the time. I can remember very distinctly what I thought in that delusion, and that was the state psych facility. Okay. I know that they allow you to roam around the ground, so, and they give you really good psych drugs. So I could smoke cigarettes, and I might be the hottest girl there. That's what I was aspiring to, you know, to be the hottest girl lost in a state psych facility. Thank God, you know, thankfully God had another plan for me. And also, you know, thankfully I was suffering from something. I was suffering from alcoholism. You know, it's a really bad case of untreated alcoholism. And that, you know, once I had addressed, you know, the spiritual sickness, that I was able to straighten out my mentally, physically, with the verbal shock. And what an awesome, awesome miracle that is. So what happened? So I left that facility. I went to another rehab. Something happened. I was willing to say yes. You know, when people had offered their suggestions, my ego kept it. Something allowed me, God allowed me, you know, to be able to say yes to some things that I would have never said yes to before. And so I stayed the whole time at this rehab, and they suggested I go to a recovery house, and I said yes. And so that brought me to New York, Pennsylvania. And in that recovery house, they told me I had to do things like get a job, and I had to go to a 12-step program, and I had to be a sponsor in that program, and I had to go to a meeting every night for 90 days, that kind of stuff. So I took a job working in a warehouse, and I, you know, started going to 12-step fellowships. Still not entirely convinced what they were selling up here. You know, I really thought this is all just a money-making racket to buy that book. Like, who's the author of that book? He's got millions of dollars. Whoever that person is, you know. Like, I remember thinking that speaker meetings, right, like, much like this, I thought that they were a group of people that got together that practiced speaking, and then they went around, kind of sharing a good word, the book that they all want you to buy, you know. So I really was really delusional about what was going on here. And it wasn't until I found a sponsor that I was, you know, really kind of shown the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous as described in the first 164 pages. You know, and it was told to me that that is what Alcoholics Anonymous is, and that these meetings are a byproduct and a wonderful byproduct, and fellowship is a byproduct and a very necessary byproduct of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, being coming into a meeting, sitting in the back, leaving before the Lord's Prayer is being said, getting my flip signed, and going bowling after the meeting is not being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous necessarily. And that really what an alpha, to me at least, what an active member is someone that's actively working the 12 steps after striving. And that is where the program was. And I didn't know that. And that, I came in and out of these rooms for a long time thinking I was doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And really I was just kind of hanging out in Alcoholics Anonymous. Which is cool too, you're more than welcome to do that. Unfortunately, if you're an alcoholic like me, that doesn't take away that restless irritable and discontentedness, and that the only thing that's ever worked for me is working a spiritual program of action, and that is taking these 12 steps. So I got a sponsor, and she showed me all these wonderful things, and she took me through the book page by page, and she showed me a solution, and she was willing to lay down her life for me. And I saw this, and she would do this for me and all the other girls she sponsored and anybody else really who stuck their hand out that they needed help. And that was really attractive to me. You know, she wasn't asking me for gas money. She wasn't asking me for anything from me. Heck, she even bought that book. But I thought that's why I was making all the money off of that. She was handing it to me. So she really showed me this incredible foundation that was available in Alcoholics Anonymous. So she told me that, if I go about this with honesty and willingness and put one foot in front of the other and take action in this program, that I will form an unshakable foundation that nothing will ever, nothing will come to be able to ever break, and that I never have to drink again and I never have to be that person that I was before. I can actually live up to my intentions. So this sounded really good. And I can say that, I had gone through the first maybe 5 or 6 steps pretty quickly. I had written down an inventory of my gross and handicaps and gone through them with her very honestly. And what happened was, I started feeling good. You start to feel good in this program. You can just hang out here for a little while. The fact that you're physically separated from alcohol will make you feel good for a little bit of time. And I started getting things. I got a better job, I got a boyfriend, I got that stuff, got a little bit of dignity back. That fear was a little bit subdued. And I thought that, if I just kept showing up, that, everything else would be fine, and I really didn't need to, work on, 10, 11, and 12. I didn't think I had to do anything consistently at all. I thought, okay, I did most of the steps, and I'm showing up, what else do I want from me, And how quickly that thought and that obsession came running back to me. Because I have this 3-part disease. I have a physical allergy where as soon as I put alcohol inside of me, something sparks, something happens, and it creates this mental obsession. And that doesn't mean that I have to be physically dependent on alcohol to crave it. What it means is that as soon as that obsession hits me, I will do anything and everything it takes to get that drink, no matter what the consequences are, no matter what the experience was in my last drunk. That I would do anything to shut that obsession up, basically, and that's the drink again. And that it's all rooted in the spirituality, and I wasn't addressing the spiritual part of my disease. I wasn't willing to do 10 or 11 at all. So, I got a car, I got an apartment, I got drunk. I was drunk too, we drank. I just drank for about 6 months. And I can tell you that I wasn't going to jail. I wasn't having guns stuck to my head. I wasn't ending up in spike boards or anything like that. But everything else is internal consequences that we all feel keep flooding off. That the incomprehensible demoralization, that remorse and pity of the drunk from the night before, that selfish and self-centered fear, that noisy loud head that tells you that you're just not good enough and that you'll never be able to live up to your expectations, always being flooded, you know, all that stuff came flooding back, no peace, no serenity, nothing. And I knew my inner self that this was going to be a really long, slow, painful death. I continued to drink the way I was drinking. So, cool thing is that I had been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had been introduced to people who looked like they were happy and sober and comfortable in their own skin and doing this, performing for free. And so I didn't have to take this great, monumentous event to get me back into Alcoholics Anonymous, but the internal consequences were just enough. And so I came back in here, not even sure that I was willing to do anything. I certainly had no faith that it was going to work for me. I thought half the things that she was telling me to do were absurd and totally inconvenient for me. But I did them anyways. She told me that I don't need to have this grand conception of God in order to do a third step prayer. But all I needed was a mustard seed of hope, and that if I kept moving my feet, that a God of my own understanding, would be shown to me in a very personal way that she couldn't put into words for me. And that it would be an experience that I would have to go through. They only would get that by putting one foot in front of the other. So I would do things like driving her down to Baltimore, to go hear her sponsor speak. I would do things like stand in the green line, read the preamble, even though I was so afraid to get up here in front of all these people. I would do things like make it to my home group consistently and act off for that night of work every single week, so I can make it to these more consistently. She showed me all these things, and I did all these things, no matter how uncomfortable they were for me or how inconvenient they were for me. And what happened was the beautiful promises of this program started happening for me. And it was undeniable that there was something very, very dramatic that was taking place in my life. And I had no idea that what it was that my ego was being deflated to the extent that I was allowing, God to come in and do this work. I had no idea that that's what was really separating me from God, the third part. It's just my ego. And that, I believe, this is just my belief, that I believe that God, gives us his free will and he allows us his ego because he loves us that much. He loves me. He was with me and loved me. Even when I was running the show myself and running it into the ground, and he's there for me, when I'm willing to put my ego aside and allow him into my life, and he comes back in and he picks up the pieces like a loving father would. And I believe that, that's the beautiful part of my relationship with God. It's such a relationship. I don't view God as this, old man in the sky, shooting thunderbolts down and punishing me for my sins. It's just my experience and my beliefs. But I believe that instead he has, he wants this relationship with us, and he wants me to talk to him, and he wants me to listen to him. And that's really where prayer and meditation come in for me. When I'm praying, I'm praying to God. I'm really reminding myself that God's in charge. God knows he's in charge. So prayer is really just a way for me to remember, to be humble and to ask for help, and I need help. And then I have to meditate. The second part about that is that I can't, a friendship or a relationship does not work if I'm just continually talking at you. I need to be quiet and listen and get direction. And that's where meditation comes in for me today. I had some amazing event experiences, and I'll quickly go over those with you because I'm running out of time here, and they're pretty incredible. So I had made a verbal amends to my family, and the people that were closest to me are the ones that I hurt the most, of course. And my family, they were very supportive, from the time I came into AA and to this day, very, very cool. And supportive of my recovery. So most of them were just, when I asked them what I could do to make it right, they just keep doing what you're doing, kind of thing. My brother and I made the verbal amends to him, and then of course, the second part of the amends is that I show up for my family, and I show up seeing what I can give and not what I can take from the situation. I show up, with the capacity to be a good listener, and not necessarily dictate and tell them what I think that they need to do with their lives. I don't have the solutions to their problems. If they ask me for a spiritual solution, I can usually find a way to kind of convey that to them. But my job, isn't to fix anybody else's life. And my sponsor made that very clear to me, from the very beginning, and that I'm not the arbiter of anybody's drinking. My younger brother, he was 18, and he was in Catholic school, and he liked to smoke pot, and Catholic school is not really cool with that, so his third infraction, they asked him to leave, and it was his senior year, and he was very close to graduating. My parents had spent a small fortune on, letting him go to the school, and the school had given him a proposition, and they said that, listen, you can either go to a 30-day rehab, inpatient rehab, and finish your coursework out there, and we will give you your diploma, or you can go to public school, and you'll get your diploma from there. And he was kind of wrestling with this idea, and he came to me, and he asked me what my experience was with rehab. And, I had, been to, 14 of them, so I had quite the experience. So I told him, didn't look like he was suffering, traumatically from alcoholism, at least not at this point. It looked like he smoked some pot. And I was like, listen, you're going to be fine. You're going to go there, you're going to eat some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you're going to pass some notes to some girls, it's going to be cake. So it's not a big deal, do it, finish your first workout, and get your diploma. So he's like, okay, cool. He goes, I end up being a therapeutic community, there's no girls there at all. He shaved his head, made more signs, whole nine. So he's there for 4 months. he comes out of there, he's not been free, really. If that was me, that would have been it. I would have been never talking to that sibling ever again. But anyway, he was pretty cool and he's been free, and he's like, whatever, it was fine, I'm glad I did it. And part of his outpatient, requirements was that he had to go to AA. He got sentenced to AA at 18 years old. And if I was 18 years old, if I got sentenced to AA, oh man, I'd be forging the signatures. Like, I thought y'all were doing Kool-Aid and, Brian Jones Dumbass. it's just crazy. I really thought that, I don't know what I thought, but I thought AA was cool. And, but he, I've been in AA now for 2 years and working a program of recovery and just, showing up for my family. And he saw what I was doing for Girls and Alcoholics Anonymous. And he, went to AA with absolutely no fear, and it really baffled me. He came in here and he gave his flip sign. And I was celebrating my 2 year anniversary actually in Pennsylvania. And he had come out to hear me speak. And probably more so to get his flip sign, but he came out to hear me speak. And after the meeting, he came up to the podium, and he asked me to stand for him. And at first, I was like, "Oh, this is sweet. What an awesome honor. Here's this kid, this poor kid that I was a horrible, treacherous sister to that would dose him with NyQuil. Steals video games. And he actually wants what I have. So that was sweet. And then 2 seconds later, I had to turn to him and tell him that I could not talk to him. And that it would be wise to get a male sponsor. And he was like, no, my counselor said it was okay. And I was like, Brian, I don't want to hear your sex inventory. And you're also on your mind. I don't think he really understood what it all entailed, sponsorship and stuff. So luckily, they were pointed in the direction of one of my friends who gladly took him through the steps, and, my brother got to the fourth step and decided he was not an alcoholic, and he moved out to Colorado and managed gypsies, and now he tours, listening to rock bands, hanging out in parking lots, just like I did. And I actually just visited him last month, and it was great, and a great time out there. And here's the thing, I don't judge my brother for the drugs he's doing, or people he's hanging out with, or the experiences he's having, or his stints in rehab, or any arrests that he may incur. I know that my job is simply to be an example of the big book, and to be there if he decides that he needs help. And I can say that he seems to be leading a very productive, happy life, doing things the way he's doing. And I just know that in my heart, if he ever finds that he is somewhere, along the line, he crosses that imaginary line between power and choice, that he knows that there's a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous that can work with that. And I know in the bottom of my heart that he knows that. That's what it's really about. It's not about me keeping people sober or teaching people lessons or, someone taking my wisdom on everybody. It's really about the willingness that I have to sit up and show up and the freeness that I receive when I do that. I lay my life down for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do that with this absolute gratitude. I am gratefully indebted to this program, and it's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. Really quickly, I'll tell you what it's like for me today. Relationships obviously have been have come back in my life through an immense process. Others have not, you know. Others have not. I went to college sober. I graduated in the top, you know, 5th percentile of my class. You know, I have a nice townhouse and a car and a boyfriend who's not an alcoholic. I have all, you know, all this stuff in my life. I have this big girl job now that lets me travel all over the country and basically attend all these parties. My job really is to attend parties where people are drinking and sell them advertising. I have this cool job. You know, all this stuff. It's good. It's a good experience. I have a ton of girls that I can sponsor and all that good stuff. Lots of friends and fellowships at Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I really have, because all that stuff can go away in a heartbeat, it really could. And what I really have is I have sons of serenity and peace. And I have a relationship with the God of my own understanding and this unshakable foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous that keeps me sober and very happy. You know, to be here. I am so, so fortunate, and all these things, you know, happened only because I was willing to be convenient and set aside what I thought that I knew so that I could let God of my understanding show me what He had in store for me. It's just hasn't transcended than what I could have come up with. So it's been an awesome journey, and I thank you very much for having me out here to speak. Thank you.